What difference does justification by faith really make in a person's life? This is Carl Kosar from Walla Walla University School of Theology. Welcome to Good Word, our weekly radio program that explores biblical and theological topics that are central to our Christian faith. Today we are back with the book of Romans, looking at Romans chapter 5. And to help us do that, I have two colleagues with me again, Dr. Bruce Johansson and Dr. Zdravko Stefanovic, my colleagues here at the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Gentlemen, welcome, and thank you once again for joining me.
Thank you. Hi.
Well, today we come to Romans chapter 5, and we've been talking a lot about theology. In fact, we've run out of time several of the last few lessons. We've got so caught up in talking special theological terminology, justification, propitiation, redemption. And maybe our readers are saying, well, this is interesting, but what practical difference does all this theological jargon have to do with how I live life on a day-to-day basis? Is there any practical benefit to all this talk about justification by faith?
That's exactly what Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 5. And that is that when we are justified by God, we have peace, we find grace, we have hope. We are hopeful people, people of hope. And at the same time, whenever we are challenged, we develop perseverance that strengthens our character. So a number of practical values are listed here in chapter 5.
The concept of peace here very often is thought of in terms of tranquility.
Like a peaceful lake that's just calm.
Yes, calm, yes. Unruffled.
Yes.
Not very, prominent, that kind of thing. I don't know. The Old Testament.
It's primarily a feeling of satisfaction being complete,
yes,
which has to do with one's health, general well-being, somewhat material prosperity. Any type of positive blessing from God is expressed through that term, peace.
Now, this in the Old Testament would be shalom, right?
Yes, and shalem would be either the verb, it can also be used as a noun, which points to completeness. It's used in a variety of ways in the Old Testament.
So we could say here that peace is not just that tranquility. I mean, it can include that, I think, but a fullness, a wholeness, that because of this, we become whole people once again.
Yeah. There's another term that it comes together with that peacefulness with God, that full, whole relationship with God, and that is access.
Can you tell us more? What do you mean access?
For me, the whole idea of access is interesting in the Old Testament. God provides ways for people to have access to him, and yet there are all, because of his holiness, you have all these barriers.
Like we don't have access to the Tree of Life, for example.
And the same thing in the Garden of Eden. Yeah. There are limits there. Mm-hmm. But with grace, we have access to God in a very new way. Because we have peace with him, we can approach him, we can feel comfortable, although I hope we don't lose the awe and mystery. It's also very interesting that many of the things that are then mentioned after this are relational things. Relational things not only to God, but...
So once again, what you're saying is that when we talk all these theological terms and so forth, this is not just abstract theology,
no.
But in the end, this is all about relationship.
It has to get a footprint in our lives. And show there.
I like kind of the middle picture that when I read these verses, when you use the word access, which was, like you said, a word that would refer to kind of access to the presence of someone.
A king.
A king, someone who's royal. Mm-hmm. So here Paul pictures that, and he sees us having access to that king, but not just access, because access wasn't always a good thing, especially if you were an enemy.
Yes.
It might be the end of your head.
Yeah.
But he says we have access to this grace in which we stand.
Stand, yes.
Which indicates that we don't just have an occasional access to the king, but we stand in his presence. He holds nothing against us. And to me, what a beautiful picture it is of the blessings of justification by faith.
Safe place to be.
Yes, yes. So, other terms, though, there, it talks about, you mentioned hope.
Mm-hmm.
We tend not to be sometimes the most hopeful people, especially when we look at our own lives, we see our faults, our mistakes. In what sense do we have hope, then?
I think that Christians have to be intentional when it comes to hope, and we need to be more optimistic than other people, because we believe that God is present in this world, that he has planned for us. And even when things seem to go out of control, God can still produce something good out of it.
Yeah. I like this phrase that we have hope, not just hope in general, but hope for what? Hope of the glory of God.
Yeah.
The glory that we've lost.
Sharing in it.
Yeah, exactly. Once again, it's relational.
Once again, it's relational. It comes there again.
You know, I think there's another term here, though, that can be kind of troubling for us. And I'm just curious your reaction to that. It says we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God, but more than that, we rejoice in our sufferings.
Hmm.
Now, that seems to me kind of odd. Sufferings usually do not, not something I usually am glad to have. In what sense can Christians rejoice in their sufferings?
I think hope gives you light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm.
If you're going into a cave and it gets darker and darker and there's no way out, life becomes meaningless without hope, without any kind of, even in a secular sense.
Mm.
Life loses meaning. We become violent.
Mm.
We become
resentful.
You know, we take it out on ourselves and on others. Life has no meaning. So hope, boy, I tell you, without hope, what is life? I think that's one of the great things that the grace that God gives us opens up for us.
Can we use adversities and odds in life
to
profit from that, to draw some kind of benefit, to learn lessons? We all face such moments. But what do we do with them? Do we constantly complain and wonder, or do we see how we can take them to our advantage?
And I think your comment goes to exactly what is said next, that suffering produces endurance. We know that it always doesn't.
No, it does not always. It can destroy people sometimes.
Yeah. But it's what you do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you said there.
I guess you could say it makes you or it breaks you in a sense. And once again, that comes down once again to Abraham. He had much adversity. Much suffering, but once again, how you react to those, he was willing and open, and God did something beautiful out of something that wasn't so beautiful.
I can remember a neighbor lady in the college where I previously taught. It was this kid who got kicked out of school, and I heard her comforting him and then telling him the end of his life had come. You know, he couldn't face his parents and all. And she said, you know what? It's not what happens to you. It's what you do with it.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Very true. So Paul goes on to mention here, and once again in verse 5, a powerful verse, that the Holy Spirit pours God's love into our hearts.
Another relational thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a hard time loving on our own, don't we?
Yeah. Sometimes. God gives us the love that we don't have ourselves.
Yes.
But
it's
what
one
is
of my
that?
Favorite verses.
Yeah, it's mine too. And what does that love look like? Is it a sentimental love?
Hmm.
Does Romans 5 here help us at all with that?
I think tough love comes in there, too.
I'm kind of leading you on here and drawing you the text. But Paul does such a beautiful job of describing this. He describes our condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's the love that loves enemies, the ungodly, the weak, the sinners, all those who really are undeserving of love, we would say. They didn't earn it.
Mm-hmm. In another letter, Paul, in 1 Thessalonians, by the way, he joins love with labor.
Mm.
He says faith works. Love labors. Different word than works.
Mm. That comes very close to the definition of love in the Old Testament by a professor, a rabbi, who defined love as readiness to serve based on all the passages in the Old Testament.
Yes. Mm. And do laboring, hard work, not necessarily always nice work. That pleases us. But I think there's something there.
In Romans chapter 5, verse 10, we get a new term that Paul uses, another theological term, and that is the word reconciliation. In fact, Paul uses this word only four times in Romans, but three occur right here in this setting. So he uses reconciliation, of course, as another metaphor. Do we really need that metaphor? We've had justification, legal metaphors. Could we have salvation without this metaphor of reconciliation?
Oh, it's so interpersonal. We were estranged, probably because of our own minds and doings.
Yes.
God never was estranged from us, but now we are reconciled to God. And that it's reconciled to God, not God reconciled to us. We are reconciled to him through the death of his son.
And which I like that point, too, because it's so easy for us to think, well, that somehow we have to earn God's love. We have to, encourage him to let things go and not hold offense at us.
Yeah.
But God is already, he's reconciled. If it's not an issue of him being reconciled to us, because that's already a reality.
Yes.
It's, will we be reconciled to God?
Therefore, since we were justified by by faith, we have peace with God.
But this leads us, it leads us to another important question in Romans chapter 5, and one that could easily take our whole time. How can Christ, who has accomplished this reconciliation, how could Christ atone for Adam's failure as well as for the sins of the entire world? How can one person do this? How did he accomplish that?
A simple answer is because he was a part of the human family and the representative of the human family. So whatever he did applies to all of us. And some of these concepts escape us today. But in the ancient world, when people lived in tight-knit communities, this was very true. Because of the foolish act of one person, the whole community would suffer. But then if one person was a genius and invented something or did something right and so on, the whole community could benefit.
But that raises a problem for us, though. Is that really fair? I mean, it kind of bothers me. And my students would do this too. If I said, here's Johnny today. If Johnny, if he gets an F, you all get an F. Well, if he gets an A, you all get an A. But if I gave them all an F because Johnny got an F, they would not be very, they'd say that was not fair. So is this really fair? I mean,
don't you use curve in grading? So others are affected, aren't they?
I think the fairness is that the gift of grace is given to all. It was taken away from all by one man.
Yes.
It was given to all by another.
And it's true. If we want fairness, then we also say, well, to be fair, then we're also on our own terms. And the good news is that his grace has been freely given to us, so we don't stand on our own.
Now, if something happens in our classes and, you know, someone does something and the whole class benefits, very few people will complain about it.
Yes.
But that type of mentality is very important, and we still have it today during the Olympic Games. If an American wins gold medal, you know, everybody talks about it and is proud. This is what we have done. Well, I didn't necessarily do it, but one of us did, and we all feel proud because of that.
I think you, too, you mentioned, I think, earlier, at least in our conversation, that we have a clear example of this even in the Old Testament with David and Goliath. So, once again, one standing for all. So.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The end of Luke's genealogy makes Adam the son of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's a title for Jesus, too. He becomes the new head of a new family.
A new representative.
A new representative. That
what
gives
is,
us hope and grace and love and all those good things.
So what is true of him is also true of us. I like how Paul says here in Romans 5 that he talks about that being a free gift to us, which it's a little bit of an oxymoron since gifts usually are free anyway. But sometimes we just can't get our minds around it. And he says, you know, it's a gift and it's a free gift. He emphasized that for us again. Well, gentlemen, I think we've truly seen today that there are many benefits to this theological talk of justification by faith. And I hope that we can experience them in our lives as well and in the lives of our listeners. Once again, I want to thank Dr. Bruce Johansson and Dr. Strako Stefanovic for joining me today. And also for Michael White for his assistance once again. Please join us next week as we continue to explore Paul's letter to the Romans. For Good Word, I'm Carl Cosart.
If you would like to find out more about Good Word, you can visit the Positive Life Radio website at plr.org. Look under the Programs section for Good Word, and you can find the official Good Word website where you can download today's show as well as previous weeks or order a copy on CD. You can find it at plr.org.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.